Well, welcome to another Michiana Adventist Forum meeting. I see we have those in the light and those in the dark. I don't know if there's any philosophical or sociological significance to that, but anyway, welcome to all of you. Our topic today is the psychology of a peculiar people. So join the club. Studies of Adventist Sabbath Keeping and Other Distinctive Doctrines, Dr. Carl Bailey, who is Associate Professor of Psychology and Coordinator of the Neuroscience Program here at Andrews, will be talking to us about some of his research in this area. And as usual, we'll have time for discussion afterwards with Gary Gray roaming with the wireless mic, so you can put in your two cents. Jim Hayward is going to offer a word of prayer as we open our meeting.
Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for this Sabbath day that we can enjoy, and pray that you will bless Carl as he talks about how we keep the Sabbath and how different people approach this day. Thank you for the blessings that you give us. Amen. Amen.
Yeah, it's easy today to forget that Sabbath keeping was once a widespread part of American culture. But it's obviously profoundly declined today. In preparing for today's program, I looked up some research done at Baylor University on Sunday keeping in America. And their conclusions were actually pretty obvious. They said, profound cultural changes over the last two centuries have transformed Sunday in the United States, so it's no longer a day set aside for worship and rest. It retains some of its earlier distinctiveness in the relative concentration of religious services and the absence of paid employment, but most people engage in other activities on Sunday, from household chores to playing sports, at the same rate as they do on Saturdays or weekdays, which just provides a little interesting perspective for Dr. Bailey's research and presentation today. Next month, on February 21, is our next forum program, The Millennial Generation and the Adventist Church, which will be a panel of scholars and perhaps consumers of the millennial generation. Dr. Meredith Jones Gray is going to be coordinating that for us. And then on March 28, Dr. Emanuela Costa-Yeagley, who is the director of the European Value Genesis Study, is going to talk to us about this large study on Adventist youth in Europe. And then in April, Deborah Brees, a local attorney practicing family law, be speaking to us about alternative dispute resolution and collaborative approaches to conflict resolution. So some housekeeping things. There's the usual sign-up sheet if you're not getting email notices and would like to have one more thing in your inbox, why sign up on the sheet in the back. And we do appreciate the work of Jim Harris and Daryl Legault in making our various electronics, audio, visual, website, etc. work, and Terry and Debbie for publicity. And we'd also like to thank those of you who have been contributing financially to give us a little budget to work with in paying for speakers and other expenses to enhance our series, so thank you again. Well, today's discussion by Dr. Bailey deals with the subject of some of his recent research on Sabbath behaviors among young Adventist adults. Carl did his undergraduate work here at Andrews with a BS in psychology and biology. Did graduate work at Michigan State, where he earned a PhD in cognitive psychology. He has an active research program here at Andrews, contributes regularly to the scholarly literature. He has a long list of research interests, including language in the visual world, visual attention, human cognition, religious cognition, Sabbath-keeping behavior, integration of faith and learning, and other things. He was born in Hamilton, Ontario. He's married to Rosemary Joy Bauer Bailey, and they have two daughters, Lily and Anna, who I understand are under the care of Grandma today. So we welcome you. Glad you're going to share with us Time is yours. Thanks.
All right, so today I'm going to talk about a couple of unique things that Adventists do and how that changes the way we think and behave, sort of to better understand how what Adventists say they believe ends up turning into Adventist actual beliefs and Adventist behaviors. Before I start, I just want to point out a few people I've worked with on this. A lot of this research comes out of student interests. I was trained to do eye tracking studies. I still do eye tracking studies. Not all of my students interested in eye tracking. So they do like doing research on religion and on Adventists, because many of them are Adventists. So a lot of this work has been done with students, honor students, also students from the behavioral neuroscience program. Chinyeri Sampson, Ariane Emanuel, Cheryl Simpson, and Paola Caceres helped out with the Sabbath keeping work. Charles Abreu and I are working on a project now. Rudolph Bailey, that's my dad, and Vilma Cristina Gomez Andrade, who are two professors, one in Brazil, one here in the US, have helped me with a study that I'll show you just in a couple minutes. And Brittany Felder helped with a little bit of a lit review on that as well. And then this work wouldn't look the way it does if it wasn't shaped by four very important people. Three, my research buddies, Monique Pittman, Vanessa Cordera, and Ante Jurancic, and then my wife, Rosemary, all of whom listen to these things over and over and over until they can explain them. So if I fall over one of them, just run up and take care of it. It'd be good. Okay, so we're going to talk really quickly about why Adventism is peculiar, and then we'll talk about two things. First, what Adventists believe about the human person, and we'll talk about Sabbath and well-being. All right, first, why is Adventism peculiar? There's lots of reasons. I'll talk about two. The first is that Adventists seem to be healthy, long-lived people. And back in 2005, the National Geographic had this article, right, which you probably remember, that had three different groups of people who lived a very long time, were very healthy, and they gave reasons for each of them. All right, this is just a graphic from the article. And one of the reasons they gave for Adventists was that Adventists keep the Sabbath. Now, if you look in the article itself, they point out that Adventists keep the Sabbath. They talk a lot about it, but they don't actually talk about any studies that demonstrate that Sabbath keeping leads to better well-being, because there weren't a lot of studies. In fact, the best study to date that has been published, because I'm still arguing with the journal about if and when mine will come out, was published last year, and it came out of the Loma Linda Health Survey work, and it's an interesting study. It shows an effect of Sabbath keeping on well-being, but the effect is kind of small, which isn't to say it's bad or it's unimportant. The effect is kind of small. Part of that had to do with a lack of variance in the sample. So we have a little bit of evidence, right? And they say in the article they have other evidence, and they do, right? I've seen a little bit of it. So there's some evidence that's being gathered now, but back in 2005, we didn't have a lot of evidence. So we've got this claim that we've made that Sabbath keeping contributes to well-being and to longevity, but we haven't really tested that claim. So part of what I'll talk about is how we do that. The thing I'll start with, though, has to do with a claim that's being made in cognitive science. So for a long time, people in cognitive science have asked questions about religion. Questions go something like this: why are people religious? Is it because they get some sort of benefit, or is this some sort of left over from an evolutionary process? Why are people religious? And the story that's being told most often now in the cognitive sciences goes something like this. People are religious because religious people are nice people, most of the time. And when we say that religious people are nice people, what we mean is that religious people get along with each other most of the time. And that allows us to cooperate in groups, and the argument is that being religious allowed us to work as groups so we could form city-states, countries, and so religiosity was a good thing for being able to become a society, as opposed to a bunch of hunter-gatherers. And this argument is made not by going back in time with time machines, but by appealing to a bunch of studies that seem to show that when people are exposed to the idea of a God who watches, they behave better. So here's one example. This is a study that was done in a psychology department in the UK that had a problem. The problem was they would have tea every afternoon. Some people would put milk in their tea. They were supposed to leave money in a basket, and they weren't doing that. Now, the solution to that problem is to do an experiment, if you're an experimental psychologist. So they set up this experiment. They made signs that said, if you're using the milk for tea, please pay, put money in the box. And every other week, they would swap out whether there were eyes at the top of the poster or flowers. Well, eyes, flowers, eyes, flowers, eyes, flowers. You can see the actual headings at the top. When they asked their colleagues didn't notice anything about the posters. They just thought they were doing things to make it pretty. I don't know, something like that. But what's interesting is that if you count up the amount of money and you divide it by the amount of milk that was consumed, every week that they put the eyes on the poster, people paid more than on the adjacent weeks. So now you know something about how to get people to pay more money for things. Just put eyes on everything. The argument here, though, is that when people feel like they're being watched, even if it's eyes on a poster, they behave better. So what if people believe in a God who watches you all the time, even in secret? You'd behave better, you'd get along with your fellow man better, and then you could do things together, right, because you're getting along. That argument is based on some assumptions, and Paul Bloom has made these assumptions most strongly, and he is probably the basis that people cite for most of these. So in his book, Descartes' Baby, back in 2004, he makes, and this is a quote from his book, he makes an argument about why people believe in a supernatural being. He says, to believe in a supernatural being, which of course you construct with your own mind, you start with the notion of the immaterial soul, as in all people start out believing in an immaterial soul. That's how kids think. Every kid, everywhere on the planet, who's a human being, right? That's his claim. You embody or modify it in an unusual way, so then you make up some extra stuff to go with it. Stir in some interesting details about what God does in history and things like that, and then you've got a supernatural being who watches you and you behave better. The important thing I want to talk about here is the first step that Paul Bloom says has to come before you believe in God, and that is this childhood belief you have in the immaterial soul, that's what drives the whole thing. So we're going to look at this claim that the belief in the immaterial soul is necessary for belief in the supernatural, and of course we can look at this in Adventists because Adventists make claims about immaterial souls. So we'll start here. We're going to look first at how doctrine affects what people think. So here we go. We're starting with this idea, the notion of an immaterial soul. Now, why would Paul Bloom say that all children believe in an immaterial soul? Well, he's making this argument based on developmental psychology research. And I'll show you one study, and I'll tell you a little bit about another one. So this is a study that claims to show that young children only develop the ability to think about the brain as a thinking organ after they're about 5 to 7 years of age. And I tried this with my daughter last night, and it totally worked. So here's how this goes. You tell people, you bring kids into the lab, and you tell them a story. You put two toy pigs in front of them, and you say to them the following thing. Stoney and Garby, who you can see right here, are just like regular pigs. Of course, being pigs, they're very different than you or I. Like, I bet you wouldn't like being a pig just grunting around all slimy and sloppy, would you? Well, they love being pigs. They like being pigs better than anything. Like, you probably like getting tucked in late at night, nice and cozy in your bed, right? Well, they hate that. They'd rather sleep outside in muddy slop. And you wouldn't want your best friend to be a pig, would you? Well, Garby's friend is this other pig, Stony. They love hanging out together. I bet you think how much fun it is to play with toys, right? Right. Well, they don't just think it's fun to grunt and chase each other around their pen. And so you tell the story to the kids, and the kids nod along. And then you say, okay, we're going to play a game now. Now, let's pretend we do something to Garby. Let's pretend that we take Garby's brain out, and then we take your brain out of your head and put it in Garby. Okay, now I've got some questions for you. First question is, do you think that Garby would still look like a pig? All right, and we're asking these questions to kids who are between kindergarten and, say, third or fourth grade. You ask these questions to kids, and they all say, Garby would still look like a pig. Then you say, okay, well, if Garby still looks like a pig, would Garby look like a pig and think like a pig? And that's when the answers differ. So it turns out that if you ask a 4 or 5-year-old that question, they'll look at you funny and say, yes. Right? If you ask a kid who's in grade 4 or grade 3, they'll say, no, Garby would think like me because it's my brain. So sometime between kindergarten and grade 3 or 4, kids figure out that if you move a brain, then you have to move the thinking that goes with the brain. Likewise, if you do a different kind of study where you say to kids, hey, here are two boxes. This box is labeled mind, this box is labeled body. And then you give them some cards, and on some of the cards it'll say something like, think about going outside, right? And you say to them, which box does it go in? And they all put it in the mind box. Or you say to them, what about being blown over by a gust of wind? Well, they say, that's body, right? So they put that in the body box. Then you say to them, well, what about pretending that you're a baby? Or pretending that you're a puddle? Or pretending that you're a kangaroo? If you ask 4 or 5-year-olds to do that task, they'll tell you that that's a body task, not a mind task. If you ask adults about that, they will tell you it's a mind task. So sometime between being 4 and being an adult, it's actually around 7 or 8, people seem to figure out that when we pretend, we use our minds, whereas if you're younger than that, you think you use your body to pretend, right? And there might be some good reasons why kids do that. So here's the really interesting thing about this. It turns out that we have good evidence that progression from thinking about mind and body separately, and there might be reasons other than immaterial soul for explaining that, that progression doesn't occur from thinking that to thinking, oh, the brain is for thinking, and thinking is what people do. People are thinking beings, right? That progression doesn't occur everywhere. For instance, most Hebrew scholars think that Hebraic thought wasn't concerned about dividing people into parts in the way that we are in Western society, right? So the Hebrews wouldn't say, oh, well, you know, people have a thinking part, people have a soul part, and people have a body part, right? They might talk about those different aspects of people, but they're not talking about them as if they're separate, right? Joel Green makes this argument very, very cogently, I think, in his book, Body, Soul, and Human Life. So here are just 2 quotes. He makes the argument throughout the book. Here are 2 quotes. First, modern views of substance dualism, this is the idea that the mind and the body are 2 separate things. Modern views of substance dualism are just that, modern, owing far more to Descartes even than to Hellenistic anthropology. So usually we blame the Greeks. We say, well, you know, the idea of dualism snuck in with the Greeks. But it turns out when the Greeks talked about a soul, they talked about a thing. It wasn't immaterial. It was an actual thing. Right? It was different than your body, but it was still a thing. Joel Green also argues that the Genesis account of human creation provides no basis for the human possession of an ontologically distinctive entity known as the soul, much less for the identification of a person's true self with such an entity. Right? What Joel Green has done is essentially take an Adventist position on the soul. Right? So the Adventist position on the soul is that it is not immaterial, that people are souls, and not they are souls in the sense that the part of them that matters is a soul. Rather, they are integrated beings, right? So our doctrine of human nature says specifically an indivisible unity of mind, body, and spirit, right? With an emphasis on indivisible and an emphasis on unity and an emphasis on the mind, body, and spirit, because we want all of those things, right? But we're talking about things in the way the Hebrews did. Okay, so given that doctrine, what do Adventists really think? Let me read the entire doctrine to you, and then let me show you what Adventists think. Here's the doctrine. Man and woman, this is fundamental belief number 7. Man and woman were made in the image of God with individuality, the power and freedom to think and to do. Though created free beings, each is an indivisible unity of body, mind, and spirit, dependent upon God for life and breath and all else. When our first parents disobeyed God, they denied their dependence upon him and fell from their high position under God. The image of God in them was marred, and they became subject to death. Their descendants share this fallen nature and its consequences. They are born with weaknesses and tendencies to evil, but God in Christ reconciled the world to himself, and by his Spirit restores in penitent mortals the image of their Maker. Created for the glory of God, they are called to love him and one another and to care for their environment, because we're creationists. So, I'm going to show you what Adventists believe about this. We're going to look at 3 samples. One is a sample of Adventist undergraduate students. Second is a sample of Adventist undergraduate students from the United States. The second is a sample of Adventist undergraduate students from Brazil. And the third is a sample of Brazilian church members. Right. Just lots of people in pews. When I show you this data, I'm going to show it to you in pie chart form. If you see a color, that means people agreed with the statement. If you see black, that means people disagreed with the statement. And if you see white, that means people were unsure what to do with the weird statement that I gave them. All right, we'll look at 12 of these statements, go into three groups. So we asked people some questions. We asked them a lot of questions. This was a study that had 61 questions and some demographic stuff. But I'm going to show you some of those. So we asked one set of questions about parts of the human person. So they never saw the question, what are the parts of the human person? They just saw these statements that indicated their agreement. One of the statements was right out of the fundamental belief, right? A person is an indivisible unity of mind, body, and spirit. The majority of respondents in all three groups agreed with that statement. And if they didn't agree, they were most likely to be unsure. But then if we ask different questions, right, so that weren't framed like an actual statement of doctrine, so the mind and the brain are two separate things, well, there we're getting about half the people overall to agree. The soul is separate from the mind and the brain. Right, that's a statement. Statement maybe of a tripartite human nature. It's a minority of people, but it's not the smallest minority, except in the Brazilian student sample. Apparently, they're thinking hard about this. And notice that in the American sample, you know, in the Brazilian samples, half the people are saying, "No, that's wrong." Right? In the American sample, it's about half the people are saying, "I have no idea." If we ask about the soul controlling the mind and the brain, you get a similar pattern to asking about the soul being separate. So that's an interesting pattern, especially an interesting pattern given that the doctrine of human nature for Adventists is right next to, not numerically, but right next to in concept, our doctrine of what happens when people die, right? The state of the dead. And if the soul is something separate, then maybe it's something that can survive the process of dying. But Adventists doctrinally are pretty sure it can't, as in you are unconscious. Your soul has no agentive power. It doesn't do anything. It can't communicate with anybody. Whatever the soulish part of you is, whatever the integrated unity of you is, has no function when you're dead. We ask questions about the mind. So these are questions about positions that are taken in cognitive science. The first and the last, the mind and the brain are the same thing, and the mind is an illusion produced by the brain. This is eliminative materialism or radical reductionism. This is the position taken by Francis Crick when he says, "You are nothing but a pack of neurons." And he means that's a good thing, doesn't mean it's a bad thing. You know, his idea in that book, The Astonishing Hypothesis from 1994, was essentially, once people come to their senses, they'll realize we don't need this idea of the soul. We can just be happy that we have neurons that are so awesome. Well, there's a lot of rejection of that idea, so Adventists don't particularly care for it. If we ask questions about, you know, other ways you might get around this, the mind is software that runs the brain, the mind is emergent, it emerges from the brain, you get some agreement and a lot of unsurety, if that's a word. Uncertainty, that would be a better word. And then if we ask questions about who is in charge of human action, is it people? Well, Adventists across the three samples believe that people have complete free will, which is good, I guess, because they also believe that they are dependent upon God for life, breath, and everything else. I mean, which is good, right? They're dependent on God and they have free will. They've just chosen to be dependent upon God. Also, about half, maybe a little more than half, will agree that God's will determines the choices that I make. Now, as I've discussed this with my wife, we don't know how they're interpreting this statement. They could be interpreting it as God's will is driving the way I'm choosing, or they could interpret it as God's will is something I'm aware of and I'm choosing to be in accordance with it, right? But at least people feel like God has some role to play in the decisions that they make. And then if we ask about indeterminacy, which is the opposite of determinism, no one can predict what will happen. We also get people agreeing with that. So that's interesting. There are people have a lot of different beliefs. There's a phrase that's used in cognitive science for what happens when you do these kinds of studies and people seem to contradict each other. It's called theological incorrectness. So Jason Sloan wrote a book called Theological Incorrectness. And in it, he argued, well, people have these beliefs, but if you ask them questions, sometimes they seem to violate their beliefs. And so clearly people say things, but they don't really believe them. Right. Well, that's one way to interpret this. Another way to interpret this is we use words and we just assign multiple meanings to those words. Right? We talk about free will, but we don't always mean the same thing. We talk about people having a soul or people as souls, and we don't always mean the same thing. Right? We're not always using technical language. And so it could be that people are just interpreting free will in different ways each time I ask about it here. Right? That's a thing that people might do, which would mean that people aren't simple, people are complex. So the way you interpret the data depends on whether you think people are simple and just don't understand their doctrine, or you think people are complex and understand their doctrine just fine, but have a lot of different things about people that they want to talk about. We did another study. This is a study that Charles Abreu and I are doing right now. If you want to get the full details of that, you can come to the Mosel conference in March, which might be fun. So this is some work we're doing right now. We're following up on Eddie Namias' work, where he asked students at a state university to answer some questions. The questions had to do with things like, you know, a bolt of lightning strikes a tree. Let's suppose you run the universe back and you get to that point again. Would the lightning still strike the tree? Right? Or you say, well, there's this woman named Jill. She wants an ice cream cone. She chooses vanilla instead of chocolate. If you run the universe back and then go right back up to that point, nothing changes, would she still choose vanilla over chocolate? Or Jill wants to steal a necklace. It turns out she does. If the universe ran the same way and got to that point where she was deciding, should I steal it or not steal it, would she still steal the necklace? Right? If people say no to some of those or to all of those, what they're saying is the universe isn't deterministic. At the point of decision, things can change. There's no way to know what will happen. If people say, well, if the universe is exactly the same up to that point, yeah, she's stealing the necklace and choosing vanilla ice cream, and then lightning will strike the tree, right? And people often answer consistently across those three questions, more than half the time. In Eddie Namias' work, he found that the most common response is to argue for indeterminacy, as in, at any point in the universe, it could go a bunch of different ways, and if the universe existed again in that exact same state, there's no way for you to know what would happen. That's an interesting view. And the majority, almost a majority of our students in this study, so 169 students, almost a majority agreed with that view, which is the same sort of pattern that you find with state university students. You find fewer agreeing with determinism, and then you find some people who just, sometimes they think there's determinism, sometimes they think there isn't. It usually splits lightning versus Jill. So given that the people have claimed this strong view of free will in the earlier study, this is pretty consistent with that. But it turns out that those views can be pushed around. So in this study, Charles Abreu and I did something to push these around. This is just a replication study from Eddie Namias' work. What we did is we gave people a paragraph to read about some aliens named Ertans. And these Ertans are on a planet, and their science is really good. So in one version, they've got neuroscientists, and the neuroscientists have figured out exactly how decisions are made. And given that they know exactly how decisions are made, the question is, can we say that the Ertans have free will? But then we have another version where we tell them the exact same story, except we say they're psychologists, and they've studied the mind, not neurons, right? And it turns out that you get the same sort of pattern. So Eddie Namias' work finds big differences. We found smaller differences, but it's the same pattern. If you present free will in the context of neuroscience, people are more likely to believe in determinism. That is, they're more likely to believe the idea that there's no way for you to change what will happen, right? You're locked in, and that's what's going to happen. If you present the exact same idea in the context of psychology, people think that they can change. People think they can modify their behavior. So what we found is this tendency to think about free will in certain ways, think about the human person in certain ways, but also an ability to push that around by how we frame the discussion. The last thing I want to show you is from the same study. This is a modification of something that Namias and his colleagues did. So they ran this experiment where they asked people to think about a guy named Jeremy. So Jeremy lives in a universe where there's a supercomputer, and the supercomputer knows everything about the future. And 20 years, so just before Jeremy is born, 20 years before a particular event, the supercomputer realizes that Jeremy will be born and that he will rob a bank. And the supercomputer knows where it will occur and when it will occur, and Jeremy is born, and lo and behold, 20 years later, he goes and robs the bank. Right? And then you ask people, does he have free will? So we took that paragraph, and we took out supercomputer and stuck in God, and it's the exact same paragraph otherwise. So they said, you know, God knows everything about the universe. Before Jeremy is born, he knows that Jeremy, when he's 20, will rob a bank. Jeremy's born. 20 years later, lo and behold, Jeremy robs the bank. Does Jeremy have free will? So here are the three questions we asked. First, we asked, is this possible? could this happen? And when we asked the students about supercomputers, they said no, because they don't believe in computers. We asked them about God, they said yes, because they do believe in God. At least they're just not confident in supercomputers. So what we know here is that these students are saying, yeah, it seems possible that God could know what I'm going to do 20 years before I do it. They're agreeing that God has foreknowledge. Then we ask them, okay, so Jeremy robs the bank. Did he do that of his own free will? And what's interesting is that in both the supercomputer case and the case of God, they overwhelmingly agree that Jeremy has free will, despite the fact that both the supercomputer and God have foreknowledge. As far as these students are concerned, foreknowledge and free will are just fine together. No problem. And then if we ask, and this is the most interesting question, then we ask, well, could the supercomputer have prevented Jeremy, or could God have prevented Jeremy from doing this? They're not sure what a supercomputer can actually do. But they're really sure that God has foreknowledge, Jeremy has free will, and if God wants to, he can prevent Jeremy. That's a really interesting batch of ideas. Right? They are, in some sense, good Arminians. So, I mean, good for you, students, thinking about theology. All right, so here's what we can say about this data. We can say that Adventists certainly do have beliefs, and their reported beliefs are sometimes very strong, for instance, the belief in complete free will, but they're also sensitive to how we frame the question. Secondly, it looks like the beliefs are sometimes contradictory, and that could be theological incorrectness. It could be that Adventists just don't know about the beliefs or don't care about the beliefs, or that they're resistant to doctrine or something like that. But it could also mean that Adventists are overloading concepts. So that's a technical term, a term from programming. You might have a function when you're writing a program, and that function might do different things depending on the context, but it's the same word, right? So Adventists might be taking concepts and pulling in information from their culture, which might be why we see some differences between Brazilian and American students. They'll be pulling things from doctrine, they'll be pulling things from their personal experience, and just loading those onto the same terms. So when they use the term, it's the same word, but it doesn't always have the same meaning, right? And we're not sure right now exactly what's going on. We'll figure it out eventually, or maybe we won't. Either way. We also have some evidence that most Adventists, and by Adventists I mean college students, feel no contradiction between free will and determinism, but they don't like reductionism. So God can have foreknowledge, you can have free will, but you better not be saying that I'm nothing but my neurons. Okay, so hang on to that for a second. I want to show you some other stuff, and I'll try to tie these two things together. So I'm going to talk now about praxis rather than, or orthopraxis rather than orthodoxy, so practice rather than doctrine. And I'll lead you through a number of different ideas. So we'll start with the idea that religiosity generally leaves people better off than they would be otherwise. So it's generally associated with well-being. Then I'll tell you about weird people and why weird people don't function like everybody else. That's why they're weird. Then we'll talk about some kinds of human behaviors, and particularly why Sabbath keeping might be related to well-being. We'll talk about how internalization of religious practices by weird people, I'll define them in a second, are related to increased well-being. We'll talk about Sabbath keeping, internalization, and I'll show you some data, and then we'll talk about what that tells us about how Adventism functions the best. And it will be a meandering path, see? Okay, so here we go. Generally, we know that religiosity is related to increased well-being. And by in general, I mean if you take all the studies across all cultures on the planet and you look at the effect of religiosity on well-being, religiosity has a positive effect. Trouble is, it doesn't have a positive effect for everybody. So there are weird people, and weird people don't get benefits, at least to the same degree. So weird people are Western, they're educated, they're industrialized, they're rich, and they live in democratic societies, and they are undergraduates in universities, and we do our research on them. So most of what we know about human beings, we know about weird people. Most people on this planet aren't weird, right? The vast majority of human beings on this planet are not weird, but we know a lot about weird people. And if we look at what happens with religiosity and well-being among weird people, you find out that religiosity doesn't help weird people. And you can actually see why once I show you these graphs. So I'm going to show you some graphs. The first graphs I'll show you compare societies that are pretty well off, top quartile, to societies that are not so well off, bottom quartile. On the y-axis, the vertical axis, I'll show you a measure of well-being. All right, in one cluster, in both clusters, the colored bars refer to religious individuals, Right? So these individuals who've said, I'm highly religious for these individuals means they say they go to some sort of religious service once a week, and that religion is meaningful to them. That's how we define religiosity in the social sciences an awful lot of the time. It's not a very high barrier. Any black bars mean that people have low levels of religiosity. Rightmost pair, the most difficult circumstances. Leftmost pair, least difficult circumstances. And here's some data. On the left side, the blue bars have to do with what happens if you ask people to evaluate their lives. Right? Is your life pretty good? You'll notice that being in poor circumstances means that your life is not very good. And you don't find any very large differences, but they're all significant. So all the differences here are significant. The reason for that is the N for this study was 455,000. If you have 455,000 subjects, you can find significance anywhere. Right? So just ignore the asterisks because they don't matter. Look for the size of the differences. So if you ask people specifically about positive emotions, in well-off societies, which is usually where you find weird people, you don't find very big differences between religious people, the colored green bar, and less religious people or non-religious people, the black bar. But in relatively poor societies, poor, difficult circumstance societies, you find a benefit of being religious. It gets you a little bit closer to being in a well-off society. If you look at negative emotions, it turns out that you buffer the negative emotions by being religious, but that really only happens if you're in difficult circumstances, right? In a society that's not as well off. That's number three. If, on the other hand, you say, well, what about very religious societies? It turns out that if you're in a religious society, you do get some benefits of being religious because you like the people around you. You fit in, right? So here I'm going to show you measure of well-being again. Again, colored bars are highly religious individuals. Black bars are low religious individuals. This time the cluster on the right is relatively non-religious societies. So the top societies, the top countries that fall under that are places like Scandinavia, right? Tends to be over there. Some Western European countries fall in that group. The United States does not, because the United States is quite religious. Although there are a lot of weird people here still. The leftmost bars will be countries with the most national religiosity. Just up front, I'll tell you that those overlap with countries with relatively difficult circumstances, right? Those two are confounded. I'm just showing them to you separately so you can see a couple of effects that look a little different. Even with 455,000 subjects, the difference between religious and non-religious people in non-religious societies is actually not significant, which means that those bars are exactly the same. In more religious societies, it turns out being religious gives you a benefit. You get the benefit for life evaluation. You get it for positive emotions. And you get, of course, the opposite for negative emotions, right? So being non-religious in a religious society gives you kind of a negative experience. Being religious in a non-religious society also gives you a negative experience. So what we know is that being weird means that religion might not benefit you. And so if I'm doing studies of religiosity here on this campus, I'm studying, well, they're not all white, but I'm studying a lot of individuals that are at least eared, right? Right. So they're relatively well off. In theory, it should be pretty hard to make their life better by having them do something religious. The other thing that's interesting about patterns that we see with weird religious individuals is that if you try to find who's really suffering among weird individuals, it's not the most religious people. And it's not the least religious people who are still attending services. And it's not the atheists or the agnostics. It's actually these people down here. So what we've got on the x-axis are people who tell us how important religious belief is to them. And so the ones that are at one, that doesn't mean that they are an atheist. It just means that religious belief is pretty unimportant, but they still go to church sometimes. It's not those people who are the least unhappy, and it's certainly not the people who really like church, right? It's the people who are somewhere in the middle who, you know, haven't really dropped out of caring, but don't really care either, right? They're somewhere in the middle, and they're far down the scale if we compare them to atheists or agnostics or people who say I'm spiritual but not religious. That's the no religion line there. They're below all of those. That's interesting because it means that the people who are most likely to leave a congregation aren't the people who are pretty indifferent but show up anyway, and it's not the people who really like being there, it's people who are somewhere in the middle. Right? And they actually don't turn into atheists, they turn into unhappy people who have left the church when we track them down in the sociology literature. So the question we asked is, well, how can we account for this? How can we account for the fact that you have these weird relationships when you look at weird people? And the explanation we looked to was an explanation of motivation. Specifically, a motivation that's related to basic psychological needs. So basic psychological needs are like basic physical needs. So if you're a tree, which you're not, you need sun and water and soil, and then you're okay. Well, if you're a human being, you need something else. You need three basic psychological needs in this particular theory: autonomy. Autonomy doesn't mean anarchy. Autonomy just means you need to feel like when you act, you have ownership of those actions. You're not coerced, right? So autonomy means not coerced. You need to be in a group that cares about you, and you need to feel like whatever it is you're doing, you have some competence, you're sort of good at. You don't want to feel like you're incompetent all the time. If you've got those three things, you'll be pretty well off, right? And your motivations will be genuine. They'll be internalized. They'll be part of you. If you don't have autonomy or relatedness or competence, or likely you're lacking in all three categories, whatever you do is going to feel like it's forced. You're either going to do it because otherwise you'll be punished, or you won't get the reward you want, or you will do it because otherwise you'll be ashamed, or you'll be afraid of how people think about you, or you'll lose social standing, or at least you're afraid you lose social standing, right? So you'll do things out of fear and guilt and shame. A lot of this work has been applied to students because often students feel like they're doing their assignments for reasons that have nothing to do with their internal motivations, right? They're doing them because of fear and guilt and shame, I suppose, or maybe because they like A's. That's another reason. We term that doing things not because you want to, but because there's some sort of outside pressure that maybe you've partially internalized. We call that introjection. So if I say that somebody's introjected, they're doing things because they've internalized something just enough to feel guilty about it, but not enough to actually think it's a good idea. It turns out that there are a number of religious practices that can show up as either internalized or introjected, and Sabbath keeping is one of them. So Sabbath keeping can be a really useful thing that meets basic psychological needs, right? And in their theoretical paper, which they couldn't test because they couldn't find enough Sabbath keepers, Didim, Sirdike, and Daniels gave this definition. Sabbath keeping is intentional periods of time set aside to restore equilibrium to the mind, spirit, and body, where a person may use his or her religious belief system to reflect on life's personal and spiritual meaning. Whether or not you think that's a good definition, that's the definition they used. And it kind of pulls out some things that are important about Sabbath keeping that could help, right? So Sabbath keeping, when it's mindful, when it's repeated, you do it every week, when it's something that requires some effort from you, when it's something that's integrated with yourself, when it's something that's meaningful, when all of those things are together, people should gain some benefit, maybe even if they're weird. And this, I think, is in parallel with how Sabbath keeping is described in Isaiah 58, right? So there's two ways to read Isaiah 58. If you're somebody who wants to go swimming on the Sabbath and you've just been told that you shouldn't do your own pleasure, then you read this differently than if you're somebody who's having a really good Sabbath. Right? So it reads, if because of the Sabbath you turn your foot from doing your own pleasure, see, that's where the crux of the argument is, doing your own pleasure on my holy day and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy day of the Lord honorable, and honor it, desisting from your own ways and seeking your own pleasure and speaking your own word, then you will take delight in the Lord and I will make you ride on the heights of the earth and I will feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. That can be read two ways, and we know it was read two ways because if you turn over to Amos 8, you have people who feel introjected. So these are people who can't wait for the Sabbath to be over because the other 6 days they were cheating people and making a lot of money doing it, and it's really a shame when you have to stop one day a week. So if the Sabbath could just be over, they could go back to that, and then God tells them what's going to happen, and it's not good. So Sabbath keeping can be very introjected, right? And actually what Art mentioned at the beginning is perfect for understanding this, because Sabbath keeping has felt introjected for most Christians in America. It felt introjected early on. So this is the caption here is the Sabbath inspection of taverns. So you can see the taverns are being inspected, and there's somebody feeling introjected with a hat over his face. And there's the stick that the deacons would use to keep you awake in church, or apparently to chase you down the tavern. Interjected, right? So they're feeling guilty. They know they're not supposed to be doing it, and yet they are. On the other hand, you can internalize Sabbath keeping. If it's true that Adventists who internalize Sabbath keeping are getting health benefits, we should see improvements across well-being, improved vitality, improved happiness, improved view of life, right? All of those things. So we decided to try to study this. So I'm going to show you some data that shows that internalizing Christian practices, I'll show it to you really quickly, internalizing Christian practices has benefits, and then I'll show you that Sabbath keeping has benefits above and beyond that, which is pretty cool. So I'm going to show you this by using charts. They're pie charts, but this time they mean correlations, not percentages. If the whole circle is colored in, that means you've got a correlation of one and you've faked your data or something, because that doesn't happen in real life. If you see something that's more like this, that means it's a correlation of about 30%. Right? This would be a correlation, maybe 60%. The more colored in the circle is, the higher the correlation is, the greater the relationship between the two variables. If the circle is red, that means it's a negative correlation. As one goes up, the other goes down. So then that would be a case where Sabbath keeping would lead you to less happiness. If it's blue, that means whatever you're doing is leading to more of the other thing. Okay, so this is just some data from Ryan, Rigby, and King in 1993, where they used this internalization interjection measure to look at four typical Christian behaviors: praying, sharing your faith, turning to God, and attending church. If you're interjected about that, you're doing it because other people are watching you. Negative correlation, about a 0.25. If you've internalized the practices, you have a positive correlation of 0.337 or something like that. Right. They found this in the college sample, they found it in a Protestant sample, they found it in an evangelical Bible worker sample, they found it in a Catholic sample. Right? It looks like this works across Christians. We've done it here on campus with a whole bunch of different size groups. We've replicated it like five or six times. We get about the same results here. Right. So if people don't like the churchy stuff they have to do, it impacts their well-being negatively. If they like it, and it's part of who they are, it impacts it positively. So what we wondered is, well, what about a really distinctive practice like Sabbath keeping that requires effort from you, right? So attending church, frankly, it's hard. I know it's early in the morning, but it's not that hard. Sabbath keeping, like real Sabbath keeping, where you do it for a whole 24 hours, that takes effort because there's college football you could be watching, there are chores you could do, there's homework, there are lessons to plan, there's all kinds of things you could be doing. And so we looked at 347 subjects. These are young adults in transition. We did this because they're trying to develop new habits. This is their first chance to do that because they're out of academy or high school. The parents aren't here to tell them what to do most of the time, so they can make some choices. We were hoping that we'd find some interjected people and maybe that they were not so well off. Once you look at later on in church samples, so we've done this study now. Cheryl Simpson did this for her honors project last year. When you look at church samples, you find the same patterns, but they're attenuated, they're smaller, because the interjected people just leave. Right? By the time you're looking at 40 and 50-year-olds, the interjected people have been gone for a couple decades. So we have reduced variability. But college students, right, they're still here, they're interjected, and they're not going to leave until after they graduate. So that's good news for us and bad news for the church. We gave them a couple of different measures. I'm just going to show you the Oxford Happiness Scale because it's the best. It's just a broad measure of well-being. It includes everything you might want to include in there: vitality, happiness, successful life, all that stuff. Okay, so we asked people about their religious practice, and I'm going to walk you through this from left to right. If people had an interjected experience of the Sabbath, they tended to have less well-being. They tended to engage in secular behaviors on the Sabbath more often, including doing chores, which just struck me as bizarre. If you're going to break the Sabbath, don't clean your house. Find something else to do, right? And they, of course, engaged in fewer religious behaviors. When we looked at people who identified with the Sabbath, that's a kind of internalization where you agree that Sabbath is good. It's not necessarily a part of you, but it's good. And integration, that's where people say, I am a Sabbath keeper and I can't stop doing that. It's just who I am. When we look at both of those groups, increased well-being, decreased secular behaviors on the Sabbath, increased religious behaviors. If you're integrated, these are people, I'll show you data in just about 30 seconds apparently. I'll show you some data that shows that these people are up an hour before the interjected people Sabbath morning. Probably because they have stuff to do at church, but also because they're happy to do stuff at church, right? This is who they are. They're excited for it. I was supposed to point at all those things. There's lots of intercorrelations. If we take these people and we cluster them, my spinning graph, And we color them, so interjected people here are red, integrated people are green, identified people are somewhere in the middle. You get three nice clusters, 2 in 7 people in this sample, and in the sample where we replicated, 2 in 7 people are in the interjected Sabbath keepers group, 1 in 7 are in the integrated group, and then that would leave 4 in 7 in the identified group. Notice that the bottom corner, like if you drew a line through that went from the top corner of that cube down to the bottom, you notice there's nothing there. Those would be the people who either didn't come here or who left after a semester because there was too much Sabbath keeping here, right? You're never going to find, if you measure this among Adventists, you're never going to find people in that corner because once Sabbath keeping becomes a burden, they will leave. Right? There's no reason for them to stick around. When we look at the three groups, they differ in the ways that match up with the correlations. Here up on the, I guess you can't see my, if you look at the top left graph there, time awakening, Sabbath morning, you can see the interjected Sabbath keepers. Tall bars mean later, so interjected Sabbath keepers sleep in. That's an interesting thing. Okay, so how can we explain this relationship? We've been doing some work. This is the most recent work we've been doing. So we've been doing some work to try to explain the relationship. One way that we've tried to do this is by saying, well, what happens if people's needs are being met every day? What if they're getting autonomy support? What if they feel like they're able to act in ways that are meaningful to them? What if they've got competence support? What if they've got people telling them, hey, you're doing a good job, right? I appreciate the things you do. What if they're getting relatedness support? What if they're in a community that cares about them every single day? When we did this, we actually found this really interesting pattern. So if you take this white bar to be the amount of difference between people and well-being that we would want to account for, right? If we can account for all of that, we know what makes people happy. And we say, well, hey, this is how much we can account for with Sabbath keeping. We can account for a lot of it. Knowing whether or not a student at Andrews keeps the Sabbath, we can explain about, 30% of the variance, possible variance in Sabbath keeping, in well-being, which is pretty cool. If we then ask, well, how much of that has to do with how they're being treated every single day? Almost all of it does. In other words, Sabbath experience for these students has to do with all the other days, which is probably a better interpretation of the Sabbath commandment than, hey, you should take one day off. If we look at other possible explanations, internalization of other Christian practices, whether or not people felt that their needs were being met on Sabbath in their best memory of the Sabbath, what kind of environment they lived in growing up, their mother, their father, it explains very little of the variance. So those are all not very good explanations. The best explanation has to do with the kinds of communities that we form. It looks like when people are in a community that meets their basic psychological need every single day, Sabbath becomes internalized. Now, I've just made a causal statement with correlational data. So our next step is to try to track this longitudinally, right? We're trying to design a study where we can track this over time and see whether or not the way people report being treated is going to affect how they keep the Sabbath in the future. All right, so why would we do this kind of research? Let me give you 4 reasons, and then we'll end and we can talk about it. I think that looking at these kinds of doctrines helps to expand the way we think about them. It helps us see things about our doctrines that we maybe hadn't thought of before. And I don't know if you know this, but the cognitive scientists are spoiling for a fight about the soul. Just about every book you read that's a cognitive science book and discusses the soul says, the Christians don't know it yet, but they're going to hate us more than they hate us about evolution. And if you look at what people believe, in America at least, we have a lot of creationist friends. We don't have a lot of friends who don't believe in an immaterial soul but do believe in God. So that puts us in an interesting position. And understanding how Adventists think about those kinds of things can be helpful. Likewise, we don't have a lot of people who keep the Sabbath the way we do, but we have a lot of people who wish they could. And so that puts us in an interesting position, and understanding how Adventists keep the Sabbath can help us explain what it is we're doing. This can help us as well when we're talking about things with each other, the kinds of language that we use. And lastly, it helps us understand more about what it means to be Adventist. Right? It helps us describe that in ways that maybe we don't talk about all the time. All right, I'm happy to talk about any questions you have. Thank you.
Characteristics you give to the weird people. How do you identify them?
Oh, how do we identify them? The label weird was actually something that was developed. So we don't actually try to find weird people. Calling people weird people is a way to explain why so much of our data wasn't working when we went outside of North America and Western Europe. So for a long time, psychologists, experimental psychologists, personality psychologists, the kind of stuff I do, did research on students. And we didn't talk to anybody who wasn't a student. And then we realized there are other countries in the world, so we said, hey, let's go there and do the studies there, and none of them worked. Right? The things that we had said, oh, this is something that is universal for human beings, wouldn't be universal. And so I think it was Ara Noren Zion, who's out in BC, developed this way of describing what was strange about the people we were studying, not what was strange about those results. The results we were getting out in the field are probably the way people are. The results we get from sophomore female white undergraduates at state universities are probably not typical of human beings. And our mistake was for a long time talking about it as if they were. Right? So I'm okay with studying weird people because my concern is trying to understand why there are so many people in these weird societies that are leaving the church, especially young people. Right? So I feel okay studying college students because I'm trying to understand why what it is about the college students that leads so many of them to not stay in the church when they leave. But generally in psychology, we don't try to say, oh, you're weird and you're not. What we mean by that is the studies we're doing here in North America probably are representative of college students in North America. We know a lot about those people. We know a lot less about everybody else, but we don't have any trouble saying things about everybody else. And so this was Noren Zion trying to caution us against doing that. Does it help?
So the weird people.
Yeah.
So the weird people are those not in your study.
No, those are the ones in our study.
Oh, they are.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we don't study typical people, right? Your typical female college sophomore at a state university is unlike the majority of people on this planet, right? There are billions of people on the planet, and most of them aren't white female college sophomores because they can't afford to be in college to start with, right?
Could you show that slide?
Yeah, I can show the slide.
It's an acronym.
Yeah, it's an acronym.
You're not talking about strange.
No, I'm not talking about strange. It's us being funny. It's psychologists being funny.
So tell me if the white college female student is weird or not.
Is she weird? She is weird relative to the rest of the world.
Okay.
As in, she's different than the rest of the world, yeah. Yeah, she's different than the rest of the world. I mean, she's a very nice person. She's not weird in that sense. But she's atypical, right? What we mean by that is knowing more about white college sophomores is not going to help us understand everybody else. I'm trying to find the slide, but they're all really tiny here. But you can see my daughters for a while. They're so tiny. Right, here we go. There's the slide. Weird people. So these are people who are Western, they're educated, they're industrialized, they're rich, and they're in a democratic society, which is not how we describe most people on this planet. Right. Yes?
When you say rich, you don't consider most Adventists and Adventist colleges rich, do you?
I consider them rich compared to most people on this planet. Right. Most of our students do not wonder where their next meal is coming from. They might not be happy about the price they pay for it. Right. But there's enough food in their communities that they can be fed. For a lot of people on this planet, that's not true, right? Not only can they not find, can they not buy food, but they can't find food. There's no food to buy. Right? So that's what I mean by rich. Yeah.
When I took this at first, it was just the U.S. you were looking at, and then our college students, and I was wondering how that compared to the U.S.
Our college students look like college students in the U.S., except for the fact that they get benefits from their religion, which is kind of atypical. So the benefits to well-being for Adventist college students are above and beyond the benefits that we see for other religious people. So other religious people get a benefit. They get a very small benefit. Adventists seem to actually benefit from internalizing their religion to a greater degree, possibly because Adventist practices put demands on you, but those demands force you to be in community with other people. And so both the feeling, I mean, you feel competent, right? If you keep the Sabbath well, it feels good, right? So that's going to benefit you. Plus, you're going to build relationships with people in your community of faith, and so that will benefit you as well. Gary's running around over there.
Carl, I was going to ask about when you're accounting for the variation in well-being, and you mentioned that has to do with treatment during the week. I was just wondering, as you were hurried at that point, if you could talk us through how you arrive at that conclusion.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's based on a survey that asks people. I think there's 21 items on there, and they ask people about how they're treated during the week. So during the week, or in your everyday life, do you feel like you can engage in the kinds of actions you want to engage in? Do you feel like what you do matters? Do you feel like what the actions you perform are performed correctly? Do you feel like people are including you or excluding you, right? So we're asking people about how they feel, and they're not taking the surveys on Sabbath. So they're telling us, I mean, there's the college students taking the surveys as part of their you know, daily college life. And so they're going to tell us about how they're feeling right then in the middle of the week. And when we look at how that instrument's been used otherwise, it correlates pretty well to what you see if people keep diaries and things like that. Yeah, at the back. Hi.
Two things. One, the issue of health. Did you control in such a way for the health practices that Adventists sometimes as a group have versus others?
Okay.
And the second thing is, there is a doctrine that is psychologically very destructive to some people, and that is the eternal hell.
Right.
And I have evidence related to that.
Yeah.
So did you control for things such as that, or are you saying those are just part of Adventism, or... in other words, you're associating something with a day of rest, but what about the factors of health and other forms of belief?
Yeah, so we didn't control for either of those things. In the Loma Linda study that came out last year, they controlled for health and found that it didn't change the effect. Right. So the Sabbath keeping benefit is above and beyond whatever benefits Adventists are getting from health. And then in our study, when we looked at Christian practices, that also was separate. It looks like the Sabbath-keeping benefit is unique. So it is an additional health practice. As far as we could see from the Loma Linda study, and because I can only ask so many questions before the students stop paying attention to the survey, we kept it to a minimum. Yeah.
On Sabbath-keeping, my observation is that many millennial Adventists like the Sabbath as a holiday, but not a holy day. That is, they may not go to church, but they don't go to work. They sleep in, and they do skateboarding.
Right.
Does that fit into their...
So this is the interesting thing, right? So remember that spinning graph I showed? The people who we would probably say, in a traditional sense, are keeping Sabbath are probably that 1 in 7 group, the group that was in green that are right up in the corner, right? And then there'll be some from that black group that had most of the people. And the people you're talking about are in that group that's 2 in 7. I know they're in that group because I asked them what they did on Sabbath. I asked them about 47 different things, some of which are traditional things you do on the Sabbath, and some of which are not. It turns out this is what happens. So yeah, you go skateboarding, but the trouble is once you've gone skateboarding, you've got this nagging feeling that, boy, if you could just do part of your assignment today, you could free up some time tomorrow because the Pro Bowl is on. And so as soon as you start doing a few things, I think everybody has kind of these nagging stresses, except for people who are really good at segmenting their lives. People have these nagging stresses like, man, you know, if I could only work on this on the Sabbath, I could have more time. Well, once you've gone down the road of doing some other things that you like doing, the things that you don't like doing but that weigh on your mind, you just start taking care of them, right? So when I looked at the people who were doing things that are entertaining on Sabbath, they're the same people who are also doing their chores and their homework, right? So it looks like going partway and saying, I'll do some fun things, opens up the door for when you're ruminating on things that have to get done, that once in a while you go, you know what, I'm just going to get that done too, and then I won't be stressed about it anymore. And I think that's kind of the pernicious thing about being introjected, is that you might say, well, I don't feel good, I don't want to go to church, I don't do that thing, so I'll do these other things. But that's not going to keep you from being introjected, right? You haven't dealt with the root problem. You still don't want to do that stuff. And so it's easy to just fall farther and farther away, which is why we have that hole at the bottom of the graph. where people eventually just say, you know what, I'm not worried about it anymore because I don't care about Sabbath keeping. I'm not a Sabbath keeper.
So the kids that are doing Sabbath as a holiday ended up in the red group.
The kids who are reporting things like what would be if you talk about being, so people who kids who talked about entertaining activities were also talking about things that are not fun, like doing their chores. Right, so I didn't see, you see some people who do. Right, and they're also, if I look at them in the, if I look at their scores, they say they're interjected. So they say the Sabbath stresses me out, and one way to cope with that is to do something fun, but the Sabbath still stresses them out.
So your research separated the kids who are viewing Sabbath as just a holiday from those who are really internalized, because I think that was.
What I'm saying is I'm not sure there are a lot of people in the sample who reported things that were holiday-like without reporting things that are stressful or things that are work. So in other words, people might be talking or acting in public like they're happy, but that's what you do when you're interjected, right? You want to be saying, yeah, I'm okay with doing this stuff on the Sabbath, and it's part of the way I am, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're having only happy feelings, right? When they're filling out the survey, and for some reason, the students seem to be pretty honest on this, because then we ask them to tell us stories about Sabbath keeping, and some of the stories are very sad stories. So when they feel bad, they feel bad. They just might be putting a different public face on because that's what interjected people do, right?
I realize this is a phenomenological study rather than a theological.
Yeah.
And given that, if we change the weirdness from those things in our society and ask the same question of Marxism, for instance, you could find a lot of weird Marxists, I suppose, that are still Marxists, still
right.
Convinced of the theology or the political ideology. I'm wondering if you could sort of equalize these two groups of people and come up to very similar conclusions by examining the types of people that still hold to Marxism
right.
Relative to those who still hold to Adventism.
Yeah, okay, so in the paper that hopefully will be accepted after the next round of revisions, which were very minor, the argument we make at the end is that Sabbath keeping works for Adventists not because, and this might get me in theological trouble, but not because it's Sabbath keeping per se, but because if you are an Adventist, one of the ways you define yourself is by keeping the Sabbath. It's very difficult to be an Adventist who doesn't keep the Sabbath. For a wide variety of reasons. And so if you can find in other groups behaviors that are costly like that, that are repeated, and that involve community, my prediction would be that you find the same kinds of results. So if Marxists do something on a weekly basis that demands something of them and is a public community act, then I would expect that that behavior would be beneficial for them as well. Yeah.
When you mention health, as another gentleman asked before, you were saying the women in the study, they take the whole health aspect as a whole, right?
Right. So in that study, they measured just about anything you can imagine about health.
Okay. But however, when it comes to psychological health, the mindset of the individual, and in this case, a Seventh-day Adventist,
right.
What I'm trying to get at, as the gentleman earlier asked, that you're not taking the theological aspect of this.
Right.
Is it possible that these students or those that you're questioning for the study, their traditional way or the way that their parents kept Sabbath and what has been passed down to a generation have less a psychological score? Therefore, the definition that they have of Sabbath is what was shown. But however, because I have a 7-year-old.
Right.
And his constant question is this. Is the Sabbath just a day that we don't do anything?
And right, okay, yeah.
As I'm driving in the car just a while ago, and I asked him, well, on the Sabbath, the sun still shines. On the Sabbath, the rain still falls. Food are still produced on the tree.
Right.
And as Jesus says, my Father and I continuously work. Then he asked me, well, then what kind of work are we supposed to do therefore on the Sabbath? Then I have to gear his mind to the point where the Sabbath is a day I start doing work in beneficial for me,
right,
but I have to work on beneficial of others. So now his view, and basically what I'm trying to do is to form his view that the Sabbath day is a day where I depend on God for my sake, but however, I take care of others who haven't had the faith or the trust that I have,
right,
to help them build that trust. So what I'm basically experimenting on my son is basically forming his psychological understanding of what Sabbath is.
Right, 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 right.
So therefore, in whatever environment he finds himself, or whatever predicament or field of work he finds himself, he could quickly adjust on what is beneficial on that day that I'm doing for myself, and how do I relate it.
Right.
So with the people that you interviewed,
yeah,
did they have that source of understanding? Or as a gentleman earlier just said, Dr. Johnston, is it they are told that the day is a day you don't do anything,
right,
so
right,
it becomes a holiday? Or do they have a... Do you see what I'm trying
yeah,
to
yeah, okay.
At?
So that's a really interesting question. And the way we got at that was a study that Paola Caceres did last year with me. So what we did was, instead of just giving people the questionnaire, we asked people to tell us about their most memorable Sabbath. And we said they could define that any way they wanted. They could define it as the best Sabbath. They could define it as the worst Sabbath. It was the Sabbath that they brought to mind when I said, tell me about one Sabbath. What Sabbath would that be? We also asked them to tell us about their home life. And so we tried to get at this two ways. The first way was, if your parents are forcing you to keep the Sabbath in a way that's harsh, that's not the only harsh thing they're doing to you, right? And so that will show up. It turns out that the way your parents treat you has very little to do with your internalization of the Sabbath. When we looked at the stories, there were themes that showed up over and over. And those themes actually had relatively little to do with whether people had internalized the Sabbath or not. So here's what we saw when we looked at the story. So people are telling us the most memorable story. Most of the people told us a good story. But there were enough people that you would say, huh, that's a lot of people telling the same story. There are enough people who told us a story where they went somewhere on the Sabbath and they needed that Sabbath and somebody treated them badly. Either somebody excluded them, somebody did something to harm their worship experience, but it was always somebody had kind of attacked them in some way, right? But then that person had done it for a religious reason. So almost all those stories went something like, I went to camp and I was going to have a great Sabbath, and then everybody excluded me and they pretended that they were doing it because they were worshiping that way. But I knew they weren't, right? So we had a bunch of stories like that. Not a majority, definitely not a majority. The other stories kind of fit, let's say, into two groups. One group was a group of people, were stories where people said, the best Sabbath for me was the Sabbath when I got a chance to, and then they named a person or a set of people that they didn't get to spend enough time with at other times, and that was a Sabbath where they spent all day with them, and it started on Friday evening maybe, or on Sabbath morning, and their Sabbath wasn't 24 hours that week. Their Sabbath lasted well past midnight, right? A bunch of stories like that where they're saying, the Sabbath for me, that Sabbath was great, not just because it was the Sabbath, but because of the fellowship of the people I was with. The other big set of stories were stories where people said, the best Sabbath for me was a Sabbath where I didn't go to church. And then they explained that instead they'd gone outdoors with a bunch of people and done church out there, not necessarily with preaching. What was interesting is that a lot of the stories where people are saying, you know, my most memorable Sabbath had nothing to do with theology, per se. They had to do with the Sabbath as a way of forming community, right? And when we looked at, you know, we went through and we coded every single sentence, you know, to try to see whether their needs being met could explain the internalization. And it wasn't explaining a lot of it. But when we looked at this data that shows that it's how people are treated every day, that's when we found the effects. And I think the reason we didn't find it for the coding of the stories is that we were just looking at one of the days during the week. So if you're able to escape for one day, that's not enough to protect you, right? And I think that if you think about the theology of the Sabbath, it's not a theology of one day. So the first substantial discussion of people outside the Garden of Eden keeping the Sabbath is not with the Ten Commandments, it's the story of the manna. And the story of the manna is a really interesting story, because in the story of the manna, right, so the manna shows up, you get manna 5 days, 6 days, 6 days a week, and 5 of those days, it rots if you get too much. The 6th day, you gather twice as much and it doesn't rot, which means that every single day you have to trust that God hasn't changed the rules, right? You have to trust God that he will supply food the next day on 5 of those days, and on the 6th day, you have to trust God that he won't let the manna spoil. And then if you look at the Sabbath commandment is about 7 days. It's not about one day. And so I think if we think about how to turn back from this, the study of people's behavior and people's thinking, to how we can find some richness in our theology, I think the fact that we find that daily experience matters tells us that if you're going to teach kids about the Sabbath, you can't wait to do that once a week. Right? The principles of Sabbath keeping matter for all of the days. And so if kids are experiencing the Sabbath as a once a week thing, that's part of the problem. Part of the problem is we haven't taught them that the trust and the rest and all of that isn't just promised to us once a week. Right? That's what God promises. Right? I mean, that's why Jesus says that his yoke is easy, right? It's because he's not talking about once a week. And so Sabbath keeping for us shouldn't be just a Saturday thing. Right? If we're really going to pull off the Seventh-day Adventist thing, I think what this kind of work tells us to do in our thinking about theology is to go back and think about how we can get the Sabbath out into the rest of the week. Right? It's a good question. Yeah.
Within the Adventist cultural context, are the introjected the liberals? Is that synonymous? And are you suggesting that liberal cultural Adventists, therefore, are less happy than conservative fundamentalist Adventists?
I do not know the answer to that question because I don't have a good liberal conservative Adventist survey. Maybe I should develop one. But here's what my hypothesis would be. My hypothesis would be that if liberal Adventists are in a church community that is a liberal Adventist church community, and they find that faith community draws them closer to God, that they will be internalized in their liberal Adventism. But that if there's a conservative Adventist in that community, they'll end up introjected. Right? And likewise, you find a liberal Adventist in a conservative congregation might feel more introjected. Now, part of that sounds like I'm about to say, oh, well, that means that we should just, you know, figure out all the different kinds of Adventism and everybody gets their own church. Well, that's one solution. It might not be the best solution. Perhaps a better solution is to plumb the depths of exactly what it is we're trying to do as Adventists as a community, right? So if the trappings of liberal or conservative Adventism are how we're defining ourselves as a community, then people are going to end up interjected if they're in the wrong community, right? I think, you know, if all we can think of is how to get our place on the spectrum of Adventism to match up correctly, we've kind of missed the point of Adventism. Right? And you know, I think all of this, one of the reasons I'm doing the research, other than the fact that research is interesting, is that I want to get enough information that I can help the university, the church, think of ways to continue to move where Adventism is, right? So Adventism started with some young adults and some older adults having this idea about how faith communities could be different. And I think that as a church, that's what we're continually called to do, right? We don't get to just stop and say, well, now we can categorize ourselves as liberals and conservatives, and we'll each have our own kinds of church, right? That's not the heritage that we have. The heritage we have is rethinking what it means to be a Christian. And I think that kind of project might help people not be interjected about the other stuff, right? That will help us kind of internalize those things. I realize that's a really idealistic thing, but I'm an academic, so I can be an idealist. Yeah.
So I may have missed this, but most of the variants that you were talking about happened within kind of horizontal relational connectedness with
right.
other people, right?
Right. Right.
Did you ask questions that were related in some way to kind of the vertical dimension, the how they spend time with God? This sense that it's not just about me and my family and my friends and the way that we spend our socialization time together, but anything that kind of related to that God relationship dimension.
Yes. Okay. So if you look at the actual content, this is the stuff I took out because I realized it would go way too long. If you look at the actual content of the three subscales that we developed, so we have this questionnaire, right? And the questionnaire has three subscales. One subscale looks at, essentially, is a subscale that tells us that people are feeling stressed about the Sabbath. They feel like people are watching them. They feel like they're being coerced to do things. The second subscale tells us that people think that the Sabbath is useful for reducing their stress. It's useful for hanging out with their friends. It's useful in sort of really pragmatic ways, kind of like a pragmatic subscale. And then we have the last subscale. That last subscale has items of two sorts. One has to do with people saying, when I keep the Sabbath, that informs the way I live every day. The other has items about how when they keep the Sabbath, it enriches their walk with God every day. So what I'm calling internalization on the scale is actually measuring both how people let the Sabbath bleed into their week and that vertical dimension. So it's definitional in what we're talking about with the highest level of internalization.
Okay, let's take our last question here. Can I get in too?
Yes.
Just quick one first. Are there any parallel studies of this in the Jewish community?
Yes. So, well, the answer is yes, and then it's unfortunate. So in 2006, a dissertation was published at the University of Rochester looking at this in Jewish communities. And what they found was that the more Orthodox Jews tended to actually get more health benefits from their religious practice. Unfortunately, the author of that dissertation died suddenly right after he published it. And he was really the only, so there have been very few studies of internalization of religion. Most studies don't look at internalization of religion for whatever reason. They use much easier religiosity measures. So the studies on Christians were done in the mid-90s. There have been a few studies done in Europe in the early part of this century. The study on Jewish believers was done in 2006, and then I'm doing stuff on Adventists. But when the guy died, that took a big chunk out of the researchers working on it. I mean, there are basically three groups here, Rochester and over in the Netherlands, and now there are two.
Thank you. One of the things that I'm hearing, as I listen to everything yeah. going on here, is the correlation between Sabbath keeping and community. Which would suggest that the Sabbath is most beneficial when it is practiced within a positively compatible, is that a good term, a community.
Yeah, among people who love you, I think would be the best way to put it.
Yeah, this of course, I'm looking at this as a missiologist.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking, you know, the problem of getting Adventists to actually make friends outside there, because that's uncomfortable.
Right.
And then in a sense, that threatens our comfort zone when we do that.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, so if I can just comment on that. If I had a dream for the Adventist Sabbath, it would be that we can both keep the Sabbath in a way that is biblically appropriate and keep the Sabbath in a way that is so winsome that we would invite people to spend Sabbath with us because it would be the best place for everybody to be. If we can figure that out, we've done something really good for this world.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks.
So the happiest moments of my childhood and adolescence, even when I was behaving badly, were Sabbaths, and especially Sabbath afternoons. I think it had something to do with biology major father, Bill and Jim, who almost insisted on an afternoon walk, almost whatever the weather was, and turned his son into a tree-hugging environmentalist. Not because he insisted on it, just he wouldn't have said that. But anyway, let's thank Professor Bailey.